From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the Day of Two Suns. 70 years ago, the U.S. began testing high-yield hydrogen bombs at Bikini Atoll in the middle of the Pacific. Its biggest bomb, Bravo.
The Bravo test was so large, the energy of it literally vacuumed in everything around it that it could. It was taking in coral, was taking in sand and ocean and water and palm trees and pulverizing it and mixing it in the stem with all the radioactive materials.
The 15 megaton Bravo shot spewed radioactive fallout on thousands of Marshallese. Little Rongelap Atoll suffered the worst.
The hydrogen bomb was so big, it spewed radioactive fallout across thousands and thousands of square miles of atolls and islands in the Marshall Islands. On Rongelap, what they got was a heavy, heavy dose of the fallout. People describe it as a snowstorm.
70 years later, the people of Rongelap and Bikini have yet to go home.
Sometimes we think they forgot what they do. I see they still try to get the radiation out from Bikini. I don't see any different. I don't see any changes. If I see people coming back, start live on Bikini, that's what I'm going to see. Now Bikini is good.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly Package Verse news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. This past Friday, March 1st, marked the 70th anniversary of the Bravo shot, the first in a series of high-yield U.S. thermonuclear tests in the Marshall Islands, just north of the equator in the Central Pacific. The Pentagon carried out 67 nuclear tests in the Marshalls, 44 at Eniwetok Atoll at the northern end of the chain, and 23 at Bikini Atoll. Castle Bravo was the biggest, and a big experiment. A fission fusion device fueled by lithium deuteride, designed by Edward Teller and Stanislav Ulam. Rated at 6 megatons, Bravo yielded 15. Thrilling news for nuclear scientists and the American military. Bad news for the Marshallese people. Just north of Bikini, fallout rained down on the people of Rongelap and Utterick Atolls. Finer particulate fallout drifted up and down the Marshalls and around the world through the stratosphere. I visited the Marshalls on the 50th anniversary of Bravo back in 2004, then again in 2007. Here are some voices from those trips. In order of appearance, American nuclear researcher Holly Barker, Rongelap residents Elio Boaz and Lamayo Abon, Canadian nuclear health activist Rosalie Bertel, the former chair of the Nuclear Claims Tribunal, Jim Plasman, the tribunal's public defender, Bill Graham, and Rongelap Senator Abaca and Jane Madison.
The Bravo test was so large, the energy of it literally vacuumed in everything around it that it could. It was taking in coral, was taking in sand and ocean and water and palm trees and pulverizing it and mixing it in the stem with all the radioactive materials.
Yeah, I see the blast. Yeah, mushroom cloud and like it's a red, color red. I don't know, it was really scary. But I didn't even know it was dangerous.
Radioactive fallout from the Bravo test fell to the ground like a white powdery substance. They had heard stories about snow before and assumed that it was snow. Children went out and picked it up and gathered it. They tasted it.
Something like powder fell on our hair, on our skin, even our foot. But we went and ate because we didn't know what was going on.
This was a shocking experience for the Marshallese after the weapon testing. It's like a big tumor filled with blood, which grows in the uterus of the woman. It's a pretty horrible experience for a woman who thinks she's pregnant and carries this tumor in place of a baby and then gives birth to the tumor. I talked to one woman and she said she held her baby until it died and then she buried it so her husband wouldn't see it.
That radioactive cesium is taken up by the plants and is present in the food chain. Well, this is a significant problem because if people were to exist on a local foods only diet, their exposure levels would exceed the US EPA standards.
Everybody in these communities has had family members die of cancer. Uterine cancers, bone cancers, lung cancers, skin cancers, stomach cancers.
This was in the open literature in 1958. This group of people provides a most valuable source of data, how radiation moves from the soil through the food chain and into human beings. Wow. It feels like maybe there was some experimentation going on here. The Marshallese were used to provide that knowledge, and they are entitled to compensation for the risks and the damages that they suffered.
The other islets, they go out there to gather food, and those little islets are as important as the main island. It's Ronglapis, and so they're not only talking about cleaning up the main island, all the islands in Rongelap Atoll to be cleaned up. Right now, the northern part of Rongelap is red hot.
Red hot?
Red hot.
People are beginning to believe, I think now, that failure to provide the funding equates to telling people they're not entitled to the same level of radiation protection as an American citizen is. Ultimately, I think that the U.S. will make they must do the right thing.
These funds are manifestly inadequate. Not only do we not have enough money, the tribunal in the near future, absent any additional funding, will be forced to close, and those unfunded awards will remain unfunded.
Yes, the problem is safe. That's what I want. I want to go home. But it's not clean.
I really always like to go back to my home island. I miss Rongelap. But the problem is, they said the northern part of the island, you cannot go there because it's too contaminated. You cannot go there.
And the U.S. government achieved superpower status as a result of this testing, but it was at the expense of the Marshallese people's health and homelands and culture. And so the Marshall Islands government sees this as an opportunity to remember what sacrifices the Marshallese people have made, but also to ask the U.S. government to take adequate responsibility for the damages and injuries it's caused in the Marshall Islands.
In order of appearance, you heard American nuclear researcher Holly Barker, Rongelap residents Elio Boaz and Lamayo Abon, Canadian nuclear health activist Rosalie Bertel, now deceased, Jim Plasman, the former chair of the Marshall Islands' Nuclear Claims Tribunal, the tribunal's public defender Bill Graham, and Rongelap Senator Abaca Anjane Madison. The history of U.S. nuclear weapons testing in the Marshall Islands, its impacts, and U.S. compensation are complicated, although U.S. government and other independent studies show that all of the Marshalls were exposed to fallout. U.S. compensation has always been limited to the residents of four Marshallese atolls out of hundreds. Those include Rongelap and Utterick. Under the terms of the first Compact of Free Association between the U.S. and the Marshall Islands, the U.S. provided $150 million to the Marshalls in full and final compensation for its weapons tests. The Marshall Islands' Nuclear Claims Tribunal adjudicated over $2 billion. The tribunal folded in 2011. On the 70th anniversary of the Bravo shot, I spoke with Giff Johnson, longtime resident of the Marshall Islands and the editor of the Marshall Islands Journal. I reached Giff Johnson in Majuro, the capital atoll of the Marshalls. Tell me about the Bravo blast, March 1st, 1954, 70 years ago. It took place at Bikini. But it really impacted a little Rongelap. Tell me about that.
So the backdrop to the Bravo test is that in 1953, the Russians had tested a deliverable hydrogen bomb, and the United States did not have a deliverable hydrogen bomb. And so it set about to show the Russians that the United States had it, and essentially to catch up to the Russians. And so the Bravo test was the first in a series of half a dozen huge hydrogen bomb tests at Bikini. And the interesting thing about it is that, you know, weather conditions were known. The U.S. had weathermen stationed on an atoll very close to Rongelap, and they were giving them hourly updates that told the people pushing the button that the winds were blowing towards inhabited islands, but that didn't matter. So March 1, the bomb went off sometime after 6 a.m., and that's why some Marshallese say it was the day of two suns, because the sun had risen already, and then the sun had risen in the east, and then the sun rose in the west at Bikini. And the hydrogen bomb was so big. I mean, it created this vast fireball. And subsequently, as the fireball went up, it spewed radioactive fallout across thousands and thousands of square miles of atolls and islands in the Marshall Islands. It contaminated the American weathermen who were on Rongerik Atoll. It contaminated or exposed the Rongelap people who were on two different atolls, Rongelap and Ailinganai, and it exposed many, many other Marshallese, although at the time, the U.S. decided only to evacuate two populations, the Rongelap people and the Utterick people, and just ignore the hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of Marshallese who were exposed, but not to the extent that the Rongelap people were exposed. And Rongelap exposure, they were about 100 miles away from Bravo. And on Rongelap, what they got was a heavy, heavy dose of the fallout. It looked like people describe it as a snowstorm of all this sand and, you know, all the debris that was lifted up by this huge hydrogen bomb test up into the sky and then blew across the islands. And because people had no warning, they knew nothing about it. And so they were just in it, right? And kids were playing in this stuff that was just coming out of the sky, and it was falling in the water catchment tanks and on their food. Meanwhile, you have to appreciate that the Americans at Rongerik had been instructed, stay inside, close the windows, just don't come outside, because they knew, the testers knew, that everybody in the fallout path was going to get blasted. And it's one of the interesting things is to appreciate that in Rongelap Atoll is about 60 little islands connected by coral reef and more or less circular. Well, the Rongelap people lived in the southern island. If they had been living in the north of Rongelap, they would be dead, because the fallout was so intense in the northern islands coming across that it was a lethal dose. It was over 1,000 rads of radiation. But just 30 miles south, where the Rongelap people were, it ended up being about a half a lethal dose. So they got really sick. They had skin burns, vomiting, their hair fell out. I mean, it was very much like the experience that people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki had with the radiation poisoning from those bombs.
Were there any immediate deaths?
So, and I forgot to mention also that there was one Japanese fishing boat, which is quite famous today, called the Lucky Dragon, that was contaminated very heavily because it was very close to Bikini on March 1, 1954. But there were also hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Japanese longline fishing vessels all around the Marshall Islands, because this was there and continues today to be the fishing, really important fishing grounds for Japanese fishing vessels. So hundreds and hundreds of fishing boats also were exposed to the fallout and had to have all of their tuna confiscated and destroyed when they returned to Japan. And that's a whole nother element of the Bravo test.
And some of those fishermen died, did they not?
Yeah, but there weren't any, like, people didn't die in the few weeks afterwards. I think one of the Lucky Dragon fishermen from Japan My memory fails on this, but it was like within a couple of years, maybe a year or two. I mean, these folks got really sick because they experienced a very high dose of radiation. And, you know, the Rongelap people were left on their island for 2 days before they were evacuated. So that increased the dose. The Utrik people were evacuated 3 days later. Now, the really important thing to understand is that the United States government had a playbook already in position that governed how they were going to manage a catastrophe like the Bravo test. And this came, some of it came from the playbook that they used in Japan when the U.S. occupied Japan after the war in 1945 and covered up and wouldn't allow reporting about the radiation health effects in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they issued disinformation and misinformation. Well, this is what the Atomic Energy Commission did, like almost from day one in the Marshall Islands. And because nobody could come into the Marshall Islands, it was a U.S. administered area, so nobody could really come in and check anything. So the U.S. just said, oh, the natives are all fine. They've been evacuated as a precaution. And it was a lie. They were really sick. They were, you know, they had been harmed very seriously. But that cover-up began on day one and continues to this day, 70 years later. And the things that were set in motion in 1954, which essentially was the creation of this myth by the United States that only four atolls in the Marshall Islands were exposed. That is Bikini and Eniwetok, the two ground zero test sites, and then Rongelap and Utrik as the downwind fallout exposed islands. Yet subsequent, many years later, secret classified U.S. government studies were declassified. And so finally in the 1990s, we got confirmation of what Marshallese knew because of health problems that they'd been experiencing, that many, many more atolls and islands were exposed to the Bravo test, and not only Bravo, but other hydrogen bombs that were tested here. So the problem with all of this is that the U.S. has dealt with a piece of the nuclear legacy, right? It has compensated the four atolls. It's providing medical care for them. But the nuclear legacy is much bigger. And the U.S. government to this day refuses to deal with all the ramifications that the Bravo test and its other hydrogen bombs caused in the Marshall Islands.
Now, I want to ask you whether or not what your assessment is of charges that U.S. Military personnel kind of, you know, intentionally left these folks on their atolls. I mean, in the beginning, it was obviously, a mishap. They had misapprehended what was going to happen. Then when they realized what had happened, there were people in the military who were thinking this is going to be a great experiment. And I remember Bill Graham from the Nuclear Claims Tribunal back in, 2004 or 2007 when I met him, read me this this famous quote from somebody saying, I'm paraphrasing, this will be a great opportunity to do some experimentation to see what the impact is on people who've been directly exposed, people who have been a little less exposed. What's your assessment of that?
So the fact is, like, there's a lot of Marshall Islanders who believe they were intentionally exposed to Bravo, and there's plenty of circumstantial evidence that supports that contention, because the U.S. government knew that the winds were blowing towards these inhabited islands, but tested anyway, and there's other things involved in it. For my view is the U.S. government, the most important thing about the Bravo test was to show the Russians that the Americans had the hydrogen bomb. And that was the overriding driver of that series of hydrogen bomb tests. And essentially, They had set March 1 as the date, and it was kind of come hell or high water, they were going to push the button because it was the Russians that they were competing with. And public health was not a consideration. And you can see it. They exposed their own people, Americans as well as Marshallese, Japanese fishermen, everybody. But once the exposure happened, then it became an opportunity for study. And it's significant that the military has a contingency for everything, of course, right? And so in the contingency playbook for the Bravo and the Operation Castle series was Project 4.1. And Project 4.1 was the study of people exposed to radioactive fallout. That's more or less the title. And it was in the manual, right? Like before the testing, because the Army or the Navy makes contingency plans for everything. What if people get exposed? So they had a plan. And the plan was you immediately bring in a team of doctors and you begin medical care and studies on the people who were exposed. And this is what happened. So they flew in U.S. doctors from American laboratories. And within a year, Brookhaven National Laboratory, which is a then Atomic Energy Commission, today Department of Energy laboratory, that laboratory was in charge of the ongoing studies of the Rongelap and Utrecht people. And so they continued to study this high-level exposed group and the low-level exposed group, right, as comparison.
And the people of Rongelap were the high exposure group and the people of Utrecht were the low exposure.
That's right. And the Utrecht people actually had a fairly significant exposure. It wasn't small, but they were told for years by the U.S. doctors, don't worry, you know, this isn't a really bad exposure. But it was 22 years later, 1976, that a whole bunch of thyroid cancers began showing up among the Utrecht people, the lower exposed folks, at a rate that was actually higher than in the Rongelap community, which was just blasted by Bravo fallout. So there were a lot of like speculation about why that was, but this important thing is the U.S. doctors, it had a very closed mind and view about what was going to happen. And the fact that they would tell islanders when they didn't know, the U.S. scientists and doctors did not know what the results of this fallout would be, but they kept telling them, don't worry, you're fine. It just indicates what their mindset was. And so in the early years after Bravo, like there were a fair number of miscarriages and stillbirths among the Rongelap people, but they were just dismissed as statistically insignificant because these are tiny populations, right? The originally exposed Rongelap population was 82 people, including 4 pregnant women. So you could say 86, right? Because they had their babies and it was 86 people who were exposed to Bravo. So it's a very small population, but there were these signs that certain health things were manifesting, but the Atomic Energy Commission doctor said, they just didn't look at it. So that's one element of the nuclear legacy. Another element is allowing these populations to move back to seriously radiation contaminated environments so that people who should never have had any radiation exposure after the Bravo test were exposed day in and day out to more radioactivity. And people who weren't on Rongelap during Bravo in March 1, 1954, were able to move back 3 years later, and they became exposed people by virtue of eating the contaminated coconuts, breadfruit, pandanus, coconut crabs, all of which, concentrate radioactivity, and people are eating it, so they became exposed.
So they moved the people of Rongelap, was repopulated again, and then they realized, oh my God, this is a disaster, so they evacuated Rongelap once again.
No, that's like way down the track because the US took them away for 3 years and in 1957 just said, all right, you can go back. They rebuilt the village. They did no radiological cleanup. And there's a quote in one of the Brookhaven National Laboratory studies in 1957 or 1958 when people moved back, and the doctors said, Wrong'ap Island is one of the most contaminated locations in the world. The habitation of these people on the island will afford most valuable radiation, valuable ecological radiation data on human beings. I mean, it's in black and white. And this is the way the doctors looked at these studies. I mean, in theory, it was supposed to be health care, but it was a study.
So they moved them back in 1958, but then they 57, but then they evacuated them once again.
No,
No?
the Wrong'ap people lived there for the next 30 years. But they saw themselves so many health problems that in 1985, they decided to self-evacuate Wrong'ap and move to an island in Kwajalein Atoll, which is like 150 miles away, to get away from Wrong'ap and the radiation on it.
And what were those health impacts they started to see?
Well, this is like long term. You had like most of the population had thyroid tumors, many thyroid cancers, but like everybody had their thyroids taken out, all like 90% of the population. And this is like the Wrong'ap population is one of the reasons the world knows so much about radiation health effects, right? Because these folks were really studied by the United States doctors. So they had a lot of thyroid issues. There were cancers. A young man who was like a year old at the time of the Bravo, he died of leukemia in 1972. And they anyway, it went on, and people were just like sickness, cancers, whatever they were seeing, they felt that it was a result of living on a contaminated island. So Greenpeace was coming out with their Rainbow Warrior on a Pacific tour, and I happened to be friends, very close friends with the senator, the parliamentary representative of the Wrong'ap people, and also friendly with a lot of the Greenpeace folks. And so when I mentioned to the Wrong'ap leader that Greenpeace was coming out with a ship, he says, oh, maybe they can evacuate us. And I remember putting Jethang Anjan, the senator, with Greenpeace International head Steve Sawyer at the time in a room and talking about this. And the Wrong'ap senator goes, can you help us evacuate? And the Greenpeace guy, Steve, goes, you mean like a symbolic evacuation? You know, we take a group down and we do a big PR event because that's what Greenpeace was good at, right? And still is very good at publicizing problems. And the Wrong'ap senator said, no. I don't want a symbolic evacuation. We want to leave, take our houses, dismantle everything, and move. And so Greenpeace was like, whoa, a totally different thing. But they agreed they could do it. And so in 1985, they made several trips back and forth between Wrong'ap and Kwajalein, delivered people, took apart all their houses, everything, building materials. And they set up a community on an island that had nothing on it. I mean, it was just like, it was a really hard thing to do, but they were scared about staying on Wrong'ap. And at the time, the US Department of Energy, the Interior Department, everybody criticized the Wrong'ap people. Oh, you guys don't know what you're doing. There's no science to support evacuation. But what happened was because they left, it put pressure on the US government to address Wrong'ap's radiological condition. So the US Congress put up some money for an independent study. And the Wrong'ap people got one of their scientists involved in it. And lo and behold, the Wrong'ap people who'd never been to college, didn't have any PhDs or physicists, turned out they were right. and there was plutonium contamination on the island. There were all kinds of issues that these independent scientists found. And the result of that was the U.S. Congress appropriated a $45 million Rongelap Resettlement Trust Fund to help rehabilitate Rongelap.
Which is not a whole lot of money.
And it didn't do enough, and it only helped one island, and there's 60-plus islands. So the Rongelap people still today have not gone back, and that's almost next year will be 40 years since they self-evacuated. And there's all these pieces to the nuclear legacy, like the Runet Dome, and a lot of people in recent years, that's had a lot of international press, this dome that encases, you know, millions of cubic yards of plutonium and radioactive elements that was dumped into a bomb crater and then capped with cement.
On Eniwetok.
Right, the former test site on Eniwetok, where people live nearby. And so that's a whole nother part of the nuclear legacy, the safety of that, the safety of islands in Eniwetok.
But now Rongelap, there was this idea quite a long time ago, back last time I was there in 2007, when Mayor Matayoshi, I think I have his name right, they were talking about starting an ecotourism dive operation at Rongelap and repopulating Rongelap. What did any of that come about? And is Rongelap still contaminated? Has it been repopulated?
No, Rongelap people have not returned to live. They have, they did put up houses. They reestablished the basic infrastructure, dock, power plant, and so forth. But the Rongelap people have been exposed, re-exposed, re-re-exposed, and they've gone through so much at the hands of U.S. doctors and scientists that they just don't believe what U.S. government people say about their island. And moreover, only Rongelap Island, the main island, was cleaned up as part of this project. And these other 60 islands in the atoll, some are still heavily contaminated. And for an islander, they use lots of different islands in their atoll because it's their food pantry and it's where they get different kinds of food. So one island, you get coconut crabs. Another island is close to a pass where all the fish come in and out. Another island is near where there's fish spawn certain times of the years, or there's turtles, or there's whatever. And they use their atoll. Well, they can't because 98% of it is still contaminated. So the Rongelap people have just said, no, we're not prepared to go back. And it's just languishing. And they did, they have been doing things like they had a bit of like trying to grow pearl oysters, black-lipped pearl oysters with some success. They did have a limited tourism thing that they tried to do. But pretty much Rongelap right now is just abandoned. I mean, there's like a skeleton crew of people who look after the buildings and whatnot, but nobody lives there permanently.
And the people of Rongelap, am I right that they are on Egit?
No, so people of Rongelap are mainly in Mejito Island in Kwajalein. That's where they self-evacuated in 1985, and it's a little tiny island in the northwest corner of Kwajalein Atoll, where the U.S. Army runs its missile testing range. And they have a little spot there that they've created for their community.
And this is a Kwajalein. For listeners, Kwajalein is like a bullseye in the middle of the Pacific where they fire ICBMs at from Vandenberg Air Force Base and Alaska.
Right. So it's a big missile testing facility. So they live on one of the little islands there, and then the rest of the Rongelap people are just dispersed. Some are on Ibai, some are on Majuro, a lot have moved to America.
How many of them are there?
Oh, it's really, how do you say, right? Like, there's probably a few thousand people who trace their roots to Rongelap, right? Maybe 3 or 4 or 5 thousand people now. Back in 1954, there were probably 300 or 400 although there were only 82 living on Rongelap during the Bravo test. But that means other people were in different islands. You know, Marshallese are very mobile folks. But without migration and with people needing health care, and the Rongelap community of all communities here has many, many health problems, a lot of which cannot be taken care of here. They need specialist kind of treatment. So people move to the U.S. So the Rongelap population is dispersed all over the place.
And a lot of their health issues, are lifestyle issues associated with eating canned food, bad canned food from the United States, because they can't live off their traditional diet. And so they suffer from cardiovascular disease and diabetes.
Well, so the way this worked out is that after the U.S. evacuated Bikini and Eniwetok and just shunted those folks off to very inhospitable islands, later on, after people went through starvation and privation and just terrible living conditions, basically forgotten by the U.S. started providing food to those Bikini and Eniwetok and also to Rongelap and Utrecht. And at first it was USDA food, you know, big containers of canned chicken, of vegetables, of whatever. So the diet really shifted away from the local diet, right? Because people were moved off their island, so they didn't have the same environment for getting local foods, and they became very dependent on the U.S. food. And in more recent times, as people got compensation, began to get a little more money, so then you just buy your food, right? So people are eating canned corned beef and Spam and canned tuna and whatever, and a lot of rice. And so diabetes is an epidemic in the Marshall Islands, and that's a huge problem. Now, you know, people in the U.S. will say, well, that's not radiation related, but it is, in the sense that the U.S. government relocated, moved people off their islands, you know, just at will, just when they needed an island. Boom, people were moved off and they were put in places where they couldn't live very well. And so they ended up having to switch to a Western diet. And so that's been a big problem, not only for the radiation affected Marshallese, but for the whole country. I mean, and in the Pacific region, the Pacific Islanders generally have an extraordinarily high non-communicable disease level, you know, diabetes, hypertension, things you mentioned. So,
Gift Johnson, we just have a few more minutes left here. Today is the 70th anniversary of the Day of Two Sons, the Bravo March 1st, 1954 Bravo shot. Today we're speaking on March 1st, Friday, March 1st. What happened in the Marshalls today? Was it commemorated?
Yes. There actually, this whole week leading up to today, there's been a whole range of activities. There's been the two colleges here in the Marshall Islands had a debate on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They had student exhibitions, a really fabulous nuclear art exhibition that was designed and produced mostly by young people. And it really shows that younger people today are taking up the nuclear legacy. And this is a very positive element to this week's commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the Bravo test, because like I've lived here for decades, and like 30, 40 years ago, you hardly see younger people paying attention to the nuclear legacy. They just disconnected from it, from their own history. I mean, this is the defining piece of history in the Marshall Islands. And most Marshall Islanders, even till today, don't know very much about it because it's never been in their school curriculum and until like 2 or 3 years ago. So the fact that we see this week and increasingly younger people, high school students, college students, getting very engaged in learning about the nuclear legacy and advocating for nuclear justice And I think that's the term that people are using, is that the Marshall Islands is seeking justice for the nuclear legacy, and the United States has not yet come through to do the things that need to be done so that people here can feel like that the government that bombed their islands, right, while they were wards of the United Nations, that government has come to the table to help rectify a lot of these problems. I mean, you can't put radiation back in the bomb. So there's some things you can't do, but you can compensate people. You can provide medical care. You can do the radiological and the health studies so that people learn what their problems are and can address them. And so those are the many things that are still outstanding.
Gift Johnson, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Gift Johnson is the editor of the Marshall Islands Journal. Read more about U.S. nuclear weapons testing in the Marshalls and paltry American compensation at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Visited Bikini Island back in 2007, across Bikini Atoll from the spot where Bravo lit up the morning sky 70 years ago, excavating a huge hole on that infamous Day of Two Suns. Bikini's leaders ran a dive operation back then for a considerable sum of money. Tech divers from around the world got to explore various mangled destroyers and aircraft carriers sent to the bottom of the atoll by U.S. nuclear bombs. We ended up stranded on Bikini. Here's that story.
My name is Clarence, and this is my partner Leona here. We'll be taking you up to Kwajalein Bikini.
Bikini Atoll is as close to the middle of nowhere as you can get. This is exactly why the U.S. tested 23 atomic bombs here in the 1940s and 50s, and why it's a challenge to get to Bikini and back. I'm flying to Bikini with Air Marshall Islands, referred to half-jokingly as Air Maybe, in the company of a half dozen scuba divers from Australia, the US, and UK, all revved up about diving the greatest collection of Navy ghost wrecks in the world.
You do notice that Peter's starting to radiate?
These guys are aware of Bikini's nuclear history and relish cracking jokes at each other's expense.
Hi guys, welcome to Bikini Atoll. If you can just make your way over to the shaded area over there and just sort of hang out for a few minutes.
Sounds like a deal to me.
All right, sounds good.
That's Jen Aykroyd, a farm girl from Ohio. She and her husband Jim manage Bikini Atoll Divers on Bikini Island, the largest on Bikini Atoll.
So what sorts of impressions do people have who really don't know a whole lot about Bikini when they get here?
A lot of people come here waving a really big stick saying Big Bad America. And, you know, in some ways that's justified.
Do you find that a lot of divers come actually knowing what happened here?
Yes. It's not very often somebody gets off the plane and we go, hey, did you know some atomic tests happened here? And they go, oh my God, let me out of here. Most people are fairly well educated about the actual events that happened. If not, surprise!
Indeed, Bikini's nuclear wrecks are precisely why divers come here. They were sent to the bottom of Bikini Lagoon in 1946 by the U.S.'s 4th and 5th nuclear blasts, codenamed Operation Crossroads. The most famous, the world's only sunken aircraft carrier, the USS Saratoga, affectionately known as Sarah.
Okay, guys, I guess I should give you an official welcome to the first dive briefing.
That's Jim Aykroyd, chief dive master on Bikini.
The most important thing you need to understand when you come and dive on Bikini Atoll is just where you are. Bikini is an extremely remote part of the world. Until things go wrong, people never really fully understand that.
Aykroyd's warning will come back to haunt us.
For now, Curly and Pedro from Australia, Brandon Graham and Pete from the UK, and Dave from San Diego burst with excitement as Aykroyd fills them in.
The ships here on Bikini Atoll, they really are unique. They are massive, 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 massive structures. There isn't really any ships like these anywhere else in the world that you can go scuba diving on. They were exposed, in a lot of the cases, to two atmospheric atomic bombs. And obviously that causes structural issues that you don't get anywhere else in the world of wreck diving.
Well, I'm following, I'm sort of doing a double profile. I'm following the VR3 so I don't bend it.
As our six divers swap tech talk, Aykroyd drives us down to Bikini Dock. Today, we'll be visiting the USS Arkansas, sent to the bottom of Bikini Lagoon on July 24, 1946, by a nuclear blast larger than the one that leveled Hiroshima. Edward Madison is one of two Bikinian divers in the operation. He sings an old Marshallese song about a cuckolded king.
Marshallese song.
What's it about?
What's about one of the king and his wife and one guy cruise around with her. And the king get mad.
10 minutes out on Turquoise Bikini Lagoon, our boat comes to a halt.
Just over 61 years ago, pretty much directly 90 feet under our feet right now, there was the world's fifth atomic explosion.
As the divers descend to the USS Arkansas, I chat with Edward Madison's half-brother, Ronnie. Ronnie and Edward are the only Bikinians living here. 150 moved back to Bikini in 1972, only to leave again in 78 when told they were being poisoned by residual radiation. I ask Ronnie when the others will return.
That's what I was asking all the Bikinian whole people. Some of them, they say, what are they gonna eat?
Couldn't they eat local food?
Nope, those local food on Bikini, it's not safe to eat, so.
So you guys are kind of like pioneers, aren't you? You're coming back and you're showing that it's possible.
Yep. It's really beautiful island. It's not so dirty.
Every night is movie night here on Bikini Island. After exploring a nuclear ghost wreck, tired but happy divers entertain or inform themselves.
In the middle of the vast Pacific Ocean lies the tiny coral atoll of Bikini. It is here that Joint Army Navy Task Force 1 will conduct the test for the atom bomb.
Those who'd rather stretch their legs can wander down crunchy paths lined by palm trees on this tiny coral island, one of 23 that form Bikini Atoll. Bikini Island is an eerie place at night. Above a beach where crabs skitter and turtles lay eggs, beneath palms that hurtle coconuts to the ground in startling thuds, a concrete pad shines in the moonlight. It's all that remains of a church where Bikinians once worshipped. 61 years ago, U.S. Commodore Ben Wyatt presented himself here, asking Bikinians to leave for the good of mankind and to end all world wars so that the U.S. could test atomic bombs on their Turquoise Atoll. A few paces away is a device operated by the U.S. Department of Energy. It's part of the DOE's continuing effort to monitor residual cesium-137 in Bikini's soil. Until it's gone, Bikinians won't be able to eat their traditional coconuts, pandanus, and breadfruit, which absorb the radiation. When local food will be safe to eat is anyone's guess. Edward Madison used to work with the DOE here on Bikini. He's frustrated by the pace of the cleanup. So how do you feel about the Americans? Do you have any hard feelings?
Sometimes we think they forgot what they do, but I see they still try to get the radiation out from Bikini.
Edward Madison is typically Marshallese. He's very polite. Sometimes, though, his irritation shows.
I work with people, those people from 1985. They still the same thing clean up. Look like they waste million and million dollars for just doing the same thing I don't see any different. I don't see any changes. If I see people coming back, start live on Bikini, that's what I'm going to see. Now Bikini is good.
Edward Madison hits the nail on the head. If the people of Bikini wants to return, perhaps they should just do it, in spite of the lingering contamination. The thousands living on Majuro and desolate Kili Island in the southern Marshalls subsist on processed food that's more harmful to their health than anything they'll be exposed to here on Bikini. But Bikinians need to be encouraged by inspired and competent leaders, qualities that seem to be lacking, as unfolding events showed.
We don't know if there's a plane coming or not.
Yeah. We don't know if there's a plane coming or not.
There's a financial issue.
We had flown to Bikini on the last of government-owned Air Marshal Islands' two functioning planes. Now, it too had broken down. We were stranded. My six tech diving companions were livid. Bikini Atoll Divers, a crucial economic development initiative of the Bikinian people, was now mud in their eyes. Finally, the Marshall Islands Sea Patrol's only vessel, the Lomore, donated by Australia and manned by Marshallese, came to our rescue.
My name is Dennis Jiwas. I'm 31.
And you're a Bikinian.
Right. My grandfather's from here.
When was the last time you were in Bikini Lagoon?
I was probably 10 years old.
How does it feel to be here now?
Oh, it's good. It's good to see the homeland.
31-year-old Dennis Jiwas is the only Bikinian on the Lomore's crew. The last time he saw Bikini, he was 10. Dennis Jiwas still considers Bikini his homeland, but he also thinks it's still contaminated.
For me, I wouldn't move my kids here with all this contamination and all this stuff, you know. If it was clean, then yeah. If everybody moved back here, I would move back here too. This is a paradise compared to Kili Island. I was born on Kili. So it's a sad thing, huh?
As if the sorrow of exile weren't enough, in early August, U.S. Court of Federal Claims dismissed a $500 million Bikinian lawsuit against the U.S. government. These funds would have been used to restore Bikini Atoll to its original state. Bikinians have been in exile for over 60 years now. They'll have to wait a little bit longer before it's completely safe to return. For more information about Bikini Atoll and U.S. nuclear weapons testing in the Marshall Islands, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.